the FBI stumble along, interview some staff, and what is this person doing in the employ of this person that we're investigating? They put two and two together, and pretty soon the whole thing falls apart. Kim ends up life in prison for aiding and abetting the murder of Rick.
This is Mind Body Matters with Greg Rennie and Rob Reiford.
Welcome to Mind Body Matters, and here I am, Greg Rennie, and there you are, Rob Reiford.
Here I am to save the day.
Muddy Mouse. I remember Muddy Mouse.
That was Muddy Mouse. Yeah. Yes, yes. Oh, geez. Let's not even go there.
We already went off on a tangent, right?
Yes, we did. But that happens every time we talk. Anyway, today on the show, are you still on the fence regarding this amp coil stuff?
Yeah. Yeah, I had a while to think about it, and as we talked last week, after our interview with Suzanne Casamento from AmpCoil, well, she's not from AmpCoil, but she's a practitioner of AmpCoil, and we had her on the show because we wanted to talk about Lyme disease. But yeah, at the end, I'm still at the same space, the same place. I am on the fence. When I first started to learn about AmpCoil, then I found out, okay, it's a thing called PEMF, so pulsed electromagnetic field therapy. I thought, hey, maybe there's something about this, and I was a believer. Then now I'm on the fence, and today we're going to figure this out, Rob.
Yes, we have the I like to call him the master of research.
Oh, yes.
And he is. And the neat thing is he loves doing this, which is great. Our good doctor, Dr. Robert Shepherd, is on the show today. And I guess without further ado, let's get right into it.
I got a million questions for him, so let's go at it. Oh, let's bring him in.
All right. Here's the good doctor. It's Dr. Robert on Mind Body Matters.
And here we are back with Dr. Robert. It's so nice for you to have you back on the show.
Oh, it's great to be back. And I've been looking forward to this conversation.
Yes, you have mentioned to me in emails that this little project we put you on, you went in depth with research. And I'm really, really excited to hear what you came back with.
I'm really excited to talk about it. And I'm frankly surprised, because when I went into this, I thought this was just be easy peasy. I thought, well, I'm going to look in and I'll find out a few little details about this, and we'll see where it leads me. But I honestly didn't expect to find very much. And I think in our earlier conversation, I even said to you, you know, are we going to be able to fill a hole?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure if we can actually do an hour on this, but...
Oh, man, I proved myself totally wrong on that one.
So as Rob and I were talking about earlier, this whole thing started with giving you the interview with Suzanne Casamento, who found AmpCoil as to be very beneficial for her illness of Lyme disease. So I gave you that interview, and like, what was your first impression when you listened to the interview?
You know, I use words like intrigued, but also a little baffled, in terms of over the course of listening, I heard a story of some personal transformation, which is always really encouraging to hear when somebody's gone through life and experienced ups and downs and setbacks and barriers and been able to overcome them. It's just really heartening, you know, and that's my work as a psychologist, is watching people do those transformative things, or in medicine, seeing transformative change. And Suzanne was describing that. But I, for the life of me, I couldn't figure out what this thing did. Oh, how does this thing work? And how does it bring, I'm familiar with Lyme disease and a number of other chronic, many other chronic illnesses like Lyme that really frustrate people who suffer with the symptoms.
Yeah.
Chronic conditions are not fun to deal with. I mean, no medical problem is fun to deal with. I was really surprised to hear about the kind of miraculous recovery when this is just not something I encounter in my practical day-to-day work.
Yeah, me neither. Yeah.
Certainly talking to my wife, who's a medical doctor, she's pretty surprised too to hear that you could have this kind of response. So I started looking into it and I just got more bewildered, to be honest. I just couldn't. I went to the Amp Coil site for the device that Suzanne was using. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I'll read up on it and follow a few other trails to see where this comes from. And I still couldn't make, it was very a good website. I've designed websites, you know, and it was a good one, really.
I've been on it. Yeah, it's very impressive. Yeah.
High quality videos. Mm-hmm. But the actual content, I couldn't find anything to explain how it worked. I found lots of words extolling its virtues and how it kind of worked with the resonances of our body and such. But when I tried to trace any of that, I really struggled. And then I started stumbling on other devices like it. And that gave me some leads into the history. And on the website, they mentioned a couple of things. A Rife device was mentioned.
I remember that, yeah.
And that, just that, got me on the trail. I also did a LinkedIn thing, you know, for the Amp Coil guy.
The CEO?
The CEO. And just to see, okay, where is he coming from? And he listed a previous business that got me into a whole rabbit hole, you know, in terms.
Okay.
So I decided, oh boy, if I'm going to really be able to try to explain this, I'm going to need to go way back, because some of this stuff was going back to the early 1900s. And when I started looking at it, I thought, I'm going to go back to the beginning. So get ready.
Oh, wow. Okay. So we're going to go back in history. So there's a thread that goes way, way back on this stuff, eh?
And if you want to, anyone who's listening, if you want to understand where this type of device or this kind of alternative therapy is coming from and where the imagery and the theory behind it is coming from, it really helps to go back to the roots, to the beginning. I'll give you an example starting way back. Probably our first experience with electricity, period, before we even knew there was such a thing, would be amber. Okay, that's the...
Like from Jurassic Park amber, is that what you mean?
Exactly, like from Jurassic Park amber.
Wow.
So essentially fossilized resin from pine trees over in Europe, falls on the ground, gets washed into a lake, washes across and is found on a beach thousands or millions of years later, and polish it up and it's beautiful. It has a wonderful luster to it, but it has this really interesting quality that if you rub it with a cloth, with a felt cloth, it develops static. So it attracts things. Okay. So if you take amber, amber quickly gained a reputation in ancient days for having somewhat magical qualities. It had this unique ability that when you took amber, if there was stuff floating around in the air, particularly if it was like felt or, you know, if you were, say, sewing, if a woman was sewing, the little bits would all gather and cluster on the amber. So we got this idea that it attracted things, that it drew things in. And if we're thinking about early medicine, which really was, we're talking about trying to heal people, having something that has a sort of magnetic quality that draws things in.
Something invisible that's very attracting about that,
and
right?
And invisible, yeah. An unknown force that pulls things in. People start wearing it, not just because it's pretty, but because they're thinking, hey, maybe it can pull stuff out of me. Maybe if I'm ill, I can use this. I can put it over parts of my body. And it doesn't hurt that occasionally, if you handle amber and you get enough of a charge on it, you'll get a shock if you're grounded and you touch it. So that adds to that sort of magical quality. You can right. just imagine thousands of nobody. There's no electricity at this point in the world other than a lightning strike, you know, and static is really the only other way that people experience electricity other than, well, I'll get to later, that's some animals that produce it. So early on, we have this idea that something can draw in that has to do with electricity. And amber is the source of the word electricity, because the early people, when they were trying to understand where it came from, they thought it came from the sun. They thought it was sunlight that had been distilled into a solid object, that the sun was coming down on the wet stones or the wet ground and was somehow coalescing into this substance that they knew as amber. And so the word electricity comes from the Greek, I think, word for this. So we've got this interesting history right from the get-go, where something really basic around the way electrons flow and the way electricity works, that humans are discovering it very early and already connecting it to healing. And interestingly, despite the fact that it really doesn't have any healing qualities, it's sap, you know.
And it's static electricity, what they discovered then, right?
It's static electricity that they discovered. Now, flash forward, several thousand years, and you get to the Greeks, and then things start to really develop more quickly, because people are starting to stumble on other forms of electricity, literally stumble, as in I'm walking along the beach on the coast of Greece and I step on a torpedo ray and I get a shock like you wouldn't believe. You know, a torpedo ray can give you a shock. It's a fish.
And, it's like a stingray or?
Like a stingray. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
It collects electrical charge and uses that to stun its prey.
Right.
And
yeah.
Fishermen noticed early on, they said, you know, thousands of years ago, that when they tried to pick it up, before they even touched it, they felt a feel, an energy coming off the fish. And the Greeks discovered that, and many other people, I think, when you step on one, you get a real shock. So one day this guy's walking along the beach and he steps on a ray and he gets a huge shock. And then he goes home and he's a slave working for this really rich dude. I'm not going to get into all the names here, but suffice to say, really rich dude looks at him and he says, "Hey, Antibius or whatever, I noticed you're not limping anymore. What happened?" He says,
"Wow."
Antibius says, "I had the most terrible form of gout, but I was walking along the beach and I got this ginormous shock when I stepped on a ray, and I just noticed that my gout's cleared up." The guy says, "Wow." He tells his physician. His physician thinks about it, goes and talks to Antibius. Anyway, long and short of it, the medical community started picking up on the possibilities of using this fish for therapeutic uses.
Okay, yeah.
And you have to think, we're back in a day when there's medicine's really struggling to try to find effective treatments for just about anything. And we don't even understand how the body works at this point.
Was this the time that they used leeches and stuff like that?
Even before. Although leeches, they go back a long way. But this is sort of the time of, leeches. Lots of really questionable therapies, others that are overused, bleeding, bloodletting, and so on.
Yes, yes.
So they started to use the trend that I'm interested in sort of describing to you is that early on, there's this pattern that something's discovered that has to do with the unknown, and that's shocking, shall we say. And quickly, the medical community and very quickly after that, all kinds of other people pick up on, hey, this could be used to heal people possibly or to some kind of medical purpose. At the time, it was commonly used to treat seizure disorders. So if people had seizures, it was mentioned in melancholia, which would be depression, So mood or anxiety problems. And, but we're talking a shock, okay? Quite a bold shock. So it would have had to the uninitiated and in a world where electricity isn't understood, getting a shock. I mean, it's bad enough to get a shock these days. You know, it's a very memorable experience. And we're talking quite a strong shock. The rays can put out up to 20,000 volts, which is 20,000 amps, which it's kind of like sticking your hand in a electrical socket. Okay. So it's quite a jolt. So there's this idea of the aura, the electric aura being a healing agent, is coming into play in medicine. And in folk medicine, it takes off. And the problem that starts very early in history is that you have your legitimate doctors trying to experiment a bit with how could we use this? And then you have all these other characters who start using it and claiming they can cure anything. And you've got a very dramatic treatment. It's something, it's a force that people don't understand and is very mysterious, but it's associated with the sun, with the gods, with magnetism of sorts. And so you have a lot of power of suggestion involved, a lot of faith involved, and people are being hoodwinked and taken to the cleaners. They're spending their life savings to try to cure incurable problems. And that's something that has followed innovations in electricity right up until today.
So if it works for one thing, then it's a cure-all for a bunch of things. And then that's where the quackery kind of comes into play?
It's kind of where the quackery, and this is where, you know, looking back in history was really helpful, because even as we move up, get much closer, like there's this Otto von Guericke. He was the first to make an electrostatic generator. Okay, so amber's really crude to try to, you know, experiment with as such. And by the 1600s, we're starting to get close to the Renaissance, when there's a lot more science is starting to happen. There are these independent people, men and women, who are starting to do experiments and trying to understand the natural world. And Guericke was the first to make a device that could create static electricity. A very simple device. He took a rod and he put a ball on the rod made of, the early versions, it was sulfur that was in the ball. It was like compressed sulfur. And if you spun it really fast, sometimes it had pulleys and cranks. If you could make it spin, it would develop a huge static charge.
I see. Yeah.
In later versions, it is made of glass and it's hollow. So, and as you know, if you rub glass in like an orb, it'll create quite a static charge.
Right.
So he was the first to devise a device, a mechanical device, that could create a static charge. And within no time, healers were starting to use this device. As a healing agent, they called it an electric aura. So already the language is starting to come into play. And this is stuff that we see in modern, if you go to websites for a lot of things that are being sold on the internet for healing that use electrical forces, they'll often refer to these terms that go way back to these early times. Move ahead another century or two, and we get to Benjamin Franklin.
Interesting. He's part of the story, is he? Okay.
He's part of the story, yeah.
Wow.
I mean, in addition to being a really important figure, you know, in American history, he was a closet scientist. Like, he did a lot of experimentation. He had a big farm and where he studied everything. He was a pretty amazing guy. But one of the things he did that was relevant to this discussion is that he took something called a Leyden jar, which is the very earliest of batteries. Okay. A Leyden jar is really just a kind of an electrostatic generator that's been put in a container. But the trick with that is you've got to generate electricity. So you have your electrostatic generator, the orb turning. So what Franklin did was he made a big glass ball, and he made a couple of pulleys, and he added some felt that was rubbing on the glass, and wires that went to the Leyden jar, which is this early form of battery that's showed up. And so he could make this thing wind up, generate tons of static electricity, which would be conducted into the battery and charge the battery. Okay. So now we're getting into a big shift here, where we've got electricity stored in an object. So he would do funny, in those days, I mean, still today, he would do demonstrations. And one of his demonstrations was to get a big line of people, hold hands, and then the one at the lucky one at the end would get to hang on to this Leyden jar and get a jolt of electricity off of it. And it would go right through the line to the last person. You know? And it was like, wow, this is amazing, right?
Yeah. And once again, this mystical thing about that something is invisible, right? It's, they don't see it, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. We're still at a point in history where we don't know about electrons, or we don't even, we're just starting to use the term electricity. A funny thing happens to one of Franklin's friends. He's built this device to do some of his own experiments. And he told a fellow experimenter about it. And this guy built his own version of it. And I don't think you could give someone a call back in those days. He must have walked over or knocked on Franklin's door and said, "Yeah, I had this weird experience the other day." "Well, what happened?" He said, "Well, I was using your device, and I can't remember." And Frank said, "What do you mean you can't remember?" He says, "Well, I couldn't remember. I woke up the next day and I had to go to my journal to find out what happened because I couldn't remember what happened." So wow. I discovered that I gave myself a huge shock with your device. And I went to bed, I got up, and I couldn't remember what happened. And not only that, my melancholia cleared up. I felt great. I felt elated. I felt really happy. So we have one of the first experiences of ECT.
Yeah, yeah.
Electroconvulsive therapy. Yeah, by accident, by a scientist just playing around with this gizmo. But of course, here's the pattern. Gradually, more and more folk remedies start appearing. Healers start going through the countryside with this device. And it's called Franklinism.
No kidding.
Benjamin Franklin was not impressed. He said, "You know, this is really, I don't like this. I don't think people should be doing this." Because they were claiming that it could cure everything.
Right.
And this is another trend in these kind of devices. The practitioners were going across with their horse and buggy, and they'd have this device, which was quite impressive to see. You know, you have to think about it. We're in a time where there's no technology, and this guy rides up and he's got this thing, and it's got this big glass orb, and it twirls really quickly, and there's sparks and stuff, and then you're going to grab this thing and you get a jolt like you've never experienced that in your life. So it becomes quackery very quickly. It claims that it can cure all kinds of conditions, and Benjamin Franklin is saying, honestly, he was once quoted as saying, "I think these people are probably getting more benefit from walking over to the healer than they are from the device." You know? He was a very prescient guy, and he understood what he was dealing with. But that trend continues in the decades and centuries to follow. Alessandro Volta, he's the guy that we use the term volt, right? He developed the voltaic pile. So it's the first battery that has a chemical battery, like you have in your car or something. He really made inroads in understanding chemistry and how it related to electricity. And of course, galvanism. Now, galvanic reaction is that chemical reaction. We've all heard the term galvanize something.
Right.
That's a chemical reaction, and it involves electricity to make it happen. Well, suddenly galvanism is replacing Franklinism and people are going all around the world giving people electric shocks using these batteries. And purportedly to heal any number of conditions. Certainly, if somebody had a seizure disorder, it may impact them while they're having a seizure. It certainly is conceivable that if you give a person, or it may set off a seizure with people.
Yeah.
People often had weakness in their limbs, like we do today, weakness in a limb or mild paralysis. And of course, if you put enough electricity through a limb, it'll jerk and move about. So that was considered part of the demonstration of its curative nature, that it could energize otherwise dead limbs. And again, coming out of electricity and the pioneering work of inventors and scientists, the early scientists, in gradually pulling apart the study of it. By the time we get to Faraday, who's just a god, he really put it all to, he put all these pieces together, and he's really the foundation of the theory underlying what we know about electricity and how it works in our world and electromagnetic forces. Now we're getting into, he was formative in the things that go into your electric car, electric motors, generators, coils, all of those things. And of course, Faradayization takes over and spreads.
Faradayization, I've never heard of that. So is that the extension of galvanism?
Of Franklinization and galvanism. Again, healers take this on and start traveling the countryside or treating the ill with using the latest, greatest devices. And in this case, we're getting to placing, it sounds kind of scary, it is really, don't try this at home, but you take a copper plate, you put it on the floor, and then the patient would sit in a chair and place their feet on the copper plate, which was connected to the generator. And then you would give them an object that would complete the circuit.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay. So as they say, you only do this at home inadvertently, right?
Yeah.
Or when you're struck by lightning, maybe.
This is bizarre. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, again, very dramatic. It can be controlled by dialing more or less energy into the circuit.
Ah, I'm piecing this together now. Okay.
So we start getting into a more technological approach, but again, lacking the sort of science of it, it's really not that useful for treating most medical problems. There's a few cases where, as we say, ECT is as a treatment for severe depression. Well, it turns out that we knew about it for a lot longer than most people realize. But even ECT, which is a proven treatment, is not common treatment. It's reserved for more severe cases because it does have some nasty side effects.
Yeah,
such
memory.
As,
yeah. Yeah.
Such as Benjamin Franklin's friend. He lost his memory for things. So we have all these changes happening. Well, so we get to our first really entertaining story in terms of frauds. Cornelius B. Harness appears towards the end of the 1800s. And he has this device. He calls it the Harness Electropathic Belt. So what he realized, he's an entrepreneur, right? He's not a doctor. He's an entrepreneur. And he sees this trend happening, these electrical things, the devices. And he thinks, oh, I could weave this into a woman's corset, or I could weave it into people's underwear, or I could put it in their shirts. And he does it. And he comes up with a whole line of clothing, suspenders, belts, all of them electrical. Because, well, no different than today. It was a fad. Everything was, people were starting to see lights in their homes if you were really wealthy. It was starting to be known that there was this stuff called electricity. And so the idea of being able to wear something and get therapy from it was really intriguing and appealing to people. And again, medicine was well, we didn't have a lot of the treatments we have today, so people were interested in trying this, and they were desperate. And one particular fellow, Herbert Tibbetts, who was a doctor, decided that he could do really well by this, so he called himself an electromedical specialist, and he advertised in harnesses, handouts, and material that he could provide. Even by then, there was a Royal Association of Physicians, the Royal College, and it did pay attention to what its practitioners were doing, and they had, by this time, a code of ethics, and they were impressed with Dr. Tibbetts making all these claims, and they were seeing all kinds of bad outcomes happening, people not getting the treatment. Because one of the things that happens with these treatments is that already there's a tendency for there are effective treatments by now, and people are not using those effective treatments, and instead they decide to wear the electropathic girdle in the hopes that that will cure them and spare them the expense and problem of some other treatment. So the college comes down and takes his life, probably one of the first cases of a medical license being revoked. as far as Mr. Harness is concerned, word got out. People started reporting that they had wasted a lot of money on these devices, that people were reporting that they didn't do anything. And then there were some expose articles. You know, this is Britain in the 1800s. The newspapers were pretty lively. And there was a big article published exposing the quackery behind it. And his fortune quickly dwindled. He had become quite a rich man, but his source of income just disappeared, and he got bankrupted by all the lawsuits that he faced from unhappy customers. So we've got all the way now to the 1900s, and we're at a point where the quackery is getting much more sophisticated, but so is our understanding of electricity. They seem to walk hand in hand. And the next step I was talking to you earlier today about is there are some other technological changes that are happening, and one of them is radio enters the scene.
Yeah, this is really interesting for me.
And, well, as you're aware, radio is a very powerful medium. It reaches out to the masses. And if you can imagine what it would have been like in the early 1900s when radio was just coming on the scene. Well, for example, the first innovators who used radio, it was used for really practical things like getting an emergency message to somebody. But they didn't even comprehend that it could be used for entertainment. Like, it took quite a while before
it's like ship radio, to ship and ship to shore communication, basically.
Ship to shore communication. In military uses in the First World War, but not entertainment. So early 20s, we have a public that is seeing a lot of technological change. We've come through the First World War, and so there've been a lot of innovations and a lot of advancements. And this guy named Albert Abrams shows up on the scene. He's an American physician who went over to Europe and trained at Heidelberg University, got his medical doctorate, came home, and for the rest of his days made fun of quacks and medical charlatans, but then proceeded, while he was being very critical of his peers and saying that, you know, despite having been trained in Europe, he insisted that America had just as good medical colleges. But he started toying with the idea of making an electrical healing device. And in particular, one that used electrons and radio. So he came up with a device. He came up with a theory that electrons were the basis of everything, which is, you know, and if you were to say that to most people, they'd say, you know, that kind of rings true. But he added to this idea that each electron, each disease has a certain vibratory rate.
Oh, okay. The all electrons vibrate differently for different illnesses?
Electrons are these sort of things, you know, that we can't see that are the basis of substance, but that there's a vibration involved, and that if we could understand disease as it's made up of electrons, it would have its unique vibratory rate. And if you were to attack it with that vibratory rate, or a counteracting vibratory rate, you could kill it. That makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Right? If you talk about it in these kind of, I mean, we're not defining any of these terms, but it, to somebody in the late 1918 up to 1920, 1921, that makes perfect sense. That's the latest theory in the technology being applied. Surely that would work. Although there's no evidence at this point. They can't even see microorganisms or anything, but we'll get to that one though. So he comes up with a device. It's called an oscilloclast. And I have to read these names off because I can't even. His oscilloclast is made up of a reflexophone, a rheostatic dynamizer, and a reagent. Okay. And so this is a guy who pokes fun at quacks.
Yeah.
And yet he comes up with a device that, well, step one is you need to take a little blood sample. Okay. So if you're going to get help treated by this device, where he's come up with the frequencies now. So he knows the frequencies that will help people. So you have to take a little blood sample or a sample of handwriting. It could be one or the other. And you put it on a plate that is connected to the oscilloclast by some wires. And the oscilloclast has some lights on it that flash and switches on it. The oscilloclast, which contains the reflexophone and the rheostatic dynamizer, gizmos that, you know, I'll save you the suspense, do nothing. There's a couple of switches in the box, you know, and a few other things. It's wired to a person. That's the reagent. Okay, so the reagent is standing there or sitting. The reagent's standing, holding on to two wires that are hooked up to the oscilloclast, and it's turned on. It reads the blood sample miraculously very high order electron physics, and it transmits information or vibrations into the person, and then the doctor or the healer percusses the individual. Percusses their abdomen to determine.
What do you mean by percusses? He pushes it, or
like your doctor, if you have if you've got a real pain in your side, your doctor will have you lay down, and he'll or she'll put her hand on you and tap, right?
Yes,
and move about.
Yeah, I understand.
That's percussing.
Yeah.
So the healer will percuss the abdomen of the reagent, and that will provide them with the information they need. Now, you have to realize they're complicit in this whole thing, because that practitioner is the person who bought this machine from Abrams, who is a genius in terms of marketing. Okay. He's not selling these machines. He's leasing them.
No kidding. Oh, wow.
You pay $200 down.
Yeah.
Which in 1920 money is several thousand dollars.
Think about it. Yeah.
And then you pay $50 a month to lease it.
Yeah.
And he has over 3,000 of these machines circulating. So you can imagine he's incredibly rich man.
Mm-hmm.
And the practitioners are each earning enormous sums. Okay. The average practitioner at this time, doctors who use this device, are earning upwards of $2,000 a week. And that's in 1920 dollars. So that $30,000 would be the rough translation dollars.
Week. Yeah.
You know, and I'd like to tell you that, you know, this all got exposed. But you know, the irony is that Dr. Abrams got pneumonia at a very young age. He died of pneumonia. A rich man, a very rich man.
He didn't get hooked up quick enough, I guess, eh?
Yeah. So, but now we're getting to some current history when it comes to amp coil. Your listener would be going, when are we getting to amp coil? Well, based on the Rife device, in the early 20s, there's a young guy. He works as a driver. He's a chauffeur for a rich industrialist in the United States. And as a hobby, he's trying to build a microscope. Okay. And his name is Royal Raymond Rife. And Raymond, or Ray, as he calls himself, Ray decides, you know, he's going to make a super strong microscope. And his patron, this rich industrialist dude, looks at what he's building. He's in this little room over the guy's garage, right? And he's got this little thing, and he's at like 19 years old. Anyway, the industrialist says, Raymond, I'm really impressed. I'm going to send you over to Europe, to Germany, and you can learn from the best. And so he did. He paid his way so that Rife could go across the ocean and study with a couple of the big optical firms in Germany. And he spent a couple of years doing this and then came back home and proceeded to work on what he called a super strong microscope. And he became quite renowned. If anybody wants to Google him, they'll see, a wiki him. You'll see a picture of him standing or sitting beside one of his microscopes. And it's a sight to behold, I have to tell you. If you can imagine taking an entire oil refinery, turning it into shiny chrome and shrinking it down until it's about big enough to fit on your dining room table, you would have a pretty good idea what his super strong microscope looked like. It was just this vast collection of tubes and prisms and all interconnected. But he claimed that using this microscope that he could see at powers up to 17,000 times.
Okay? Mm.
Now, this is something that anybody who's a fan of Rife, and there are still, as we're going to get to, many adherents, will say, you know, he invented this incredible microscope. But, you know, in optics, you can't go above about 2,000 times and get a picture and get a clear image.
Yeah, that amount kind of seemed weird to me, yeah.
By the time you get to a certain point, well before 17,000 times, you're getting below the frequency of light. Like light starts to be impossible to resolve because it's in wavelengths, and those wavelengths are getting in between here, and all you'll get is a blur, is what I was gonna say. So you have to go to something like an electron microscope, which is an electronic device.
I thought that's where we're going. I was going to ask about the electron microscope.
Well, no, he doesn't go there. He has an optical microscope that,
okay,
is more powerful than the electron microscope, which came a couple of decades later.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Okay. So he has this optical microscope, and inspired by the work of Abrams and modern radio, which has come on the scene. And what radio is you're just taking voice, right, and your microphone. You're converting it into an electrical wave from a vocal wave. And then you amp that, you increase the frequency tremendously so that it will now pass through air quite easily for great distances. And then the other end picks up that electrical frequency and it brings it back down to the frequency of a voice, puts it through an amplifier, a speaker, and voila. Well, he said, let's take these radio frequencies and beam them at these. I can see a cancer virus with my microscope, and I'm going to beam it with what I call my oscillating beam ray, which is a radio wave beam ray, and I'm going to kill, and I can kill, I've watched it through my microscope, and I can see the cancer cell die when I do this. People are really intrigued, and again, we don't have electron microscopes yet. Microscopes themselves are pretty newfangled and advancing. We don't know what the limit is yet. And he's selling these at exorbitant prices to people, and then they don't work. And he's insisting, well, if you've ever seen one, you would understand. He'll just say, well, you didn't put it together properly. You know? So, so he's becoming quite wealthy, but the Rief machines are even more popular. They're a device that if you tune them to the frequencies that he's designated, will kill disease organisms in your body, will neutralize diseases in the body like cancer, and most notably cancer. So here we go again. Rife machines spread all across the continental United States, being sold by any number of practitioners and being used in medical clinics and quack clinics all across the states. Uh-huh. And these machines are doing nothing. There's no science behind it. Once again, word starts getting around, and only this time the American Medical Association gets involved. The American Public Health Department gets involved and says, you can't be doing this. They publish papers dismissing the theory behind the Rife machines and the use of the Rife machines. And Rife ends up gradually withering. His sales drop, and he falls into the poorhouse and dies very bitter, insisting that this was all a big conspiracy theory, that the public health department didn't want people to know that he had a cure for cancer. Flash forward to the latter part of the last century, and we've got a guy named Barry Lins who decides in a short course of 3 weeks to write a bestseller. So here he decides that he likes this story about Raymond Rife, and he sees some really good potential there. So he writes a book called The Cancer Cure That Worked, 50 Years of Suppression. And in 3 weeks, he cobbles this book together that takes all kinds of unrelated bits and pieces, most of it hearsay and none of it really factual, and weaves a very compelling conspiracy tale that Rife's machine, that his microscope did work, and that it was suppressed, and that the Rife machine was suppressed because the American medical community didn't want people getting better.
Okay.
Yeah. They wanted to prop up the pharmaceutical industry and yada, come up with all kinds of different conspiracy rationalizations to the effect that this thing really worked. And he puts it up on Amazon. And lo and behold, of course, who goes reading this but a whole bunch of people who have more of a business bent to them, shall we say. And they see an opportunity because in the alternate medicine community, people are discovering this book and it kind of fits with some of their suspiciousness about medicine and the medical world.
And pharmaceuticals, yeah.
So he... So the Rife machine undergoes another wave of popularity. It starts spreading. They're starting to be used again. And we're talking now, we're into the late 1980s, 1990s. And these machines are now being produced and sold for large sums. So anywhere from $1,000 up to $20,000 for a Rife machine. An example, you can decide whether you want to include this in here.
Oh, I'll include it. We need it. We need to know the other side of these things.
So an example of the kind of practitioner that, or the kind of person that picked up on Rife machines was a gal named Kimberly Bailey. She's a business-minded gal living down in the southern U.S. And, she started selling Rife machines under a variety of names, and claiming that they could cure any number of maladies. And she was selling them, quite a few of them, as a matter of fact. And as a matter of fact, she became quite wealthy. She was a millionaire, and she lived on a farm where she had staff running this business, kind of a mail order business. And she had practitioners through the states who would use these devices with their patients. So But she was concerned. She was starting to feel a bit paranoid. She had all this money. The FDA were starting to look and be a bit concerned about this device and were starting to snoop around. And she was worried that one of her employees might be stealing from her. So she hired a private detective. She hired a detective named Rick Post, who was an authentic, bona fide private detective in the California area. And he went to work for her, and he brought his a young associate of his, Rick Krueger, along. And quickly, he got along really well with this gal, with Kimberly. And they had a bit of a romance, and he started running her company for her. He said, you know, I can help you out running this company. And he did. Except his young associate, Mr. Krueger, didn't feel he was getting paid enough. And he was angry with his boss for crossing the line with their employer. So he told Kimberly that Rick was sleeping around and that he was stealing money from her business, which, of course, set Kim into a rage. Here she is trusting this guy. He's an investigator. She's trusted him with her personal life and with her business. And now he goes and betrays her. Well, I don't think Mr. Krueger quite banked on how far this would go, but Kim decides she's going to punish this guy. She's going to punish him. Okay. She gets Krueger to help her find somebody who can kidnap this private investigator. And things unfold, and Krueger helps her because he's kind of up to his neck by now, you know. So he helps her come up with this plan. He gets this guy he knows, Humberto Uribe, to take Rick down to Mexico on a business trip, a supposed business trip. Well, it turns out that it wasn't a business trip. There's some additional Mexican citizens waiting there, probably some cartel members or something, and they kidnap him and put him in a hole in the ground and torture him. And Kim insists on being there when he's tortured, and it just goes from bad to worse.
My God.
The long and short is that poor Rick ends up being murdered. They realize that they've gone too far. She needs to get rid of him. So she tells this Umberto guy, do what you have to with him. Well, of course, he kills him. Krueger now realizes that this isn't good. He's an investigator, after all. He realizes that he's implicated in this.
Yeah.
He had tried to leave a trail and set up, made Rick record a bogus voicemail saying he was going on a trip and, you know, so that he would disappear. But in the long and short of it, the FBI caught wind, and Rick was missing, after all, and had left a family behind. So the FBI goes snooping around. By now, Kimberly has hired a gal named Svetlana Ogordanovka to be on her staff. And I think she likes Svetlana because Svetlana had been a Russian spy back in the day. This just sounds so ridiculous.
This is ridiculous. This is just out of a book of fiction, but this is what happened.
It's mine. But I only tell you this story because it gets you into the mindset of the kind of individual who will get into this kind of business of selling bogus medical devices to people and exploiting people. And they're not nice people. In many cases, they're not. In some, they're just trying to make a quick buck. And in many cases, they're doing all kinds of nefarious things. And this gal, the long and short is that the FBI stumble along, interview some staff, and they know Svetlana, of course, because they've run across her. She was in jail for espionage, for God's sake. So they're like, what is this person doing in the employ of this person that we're investigating over the disappearance of? They put two and two together, and pretty soon the whole thing falls apart, and Kim ends up life in prison for aiding and abetting the murder of Rick. And yet some associates of hers continue for years after into the early 2000s selling the devices and themselves end up in prison as well. But now we're getting to the current day because we're now at a point where the coil innovation comes in. During this period when Kim was running her business, the late 90s, a fellow named Doug McLean had Lyme disease, and he had read about Royal Rife and his machines, and he'd seen these Rife machines being sold, and he decided he would make a coil version of it where he coils copper wire and can make pulsed electromagnetic frequencies, kind of like radio waves or like something you'd get out of a speaker in your sound system. And this is going to be a healing device, and he uses it on himself, and he feels that it's helping. And this is one of the fellows in this whole long list who seems genuine. He honestly believes that this is helping him. As to whether it is, there's really no evidence that PEMF has any impact on any health conditions.
Could that have been a placebo effect that starts to happen for people, or?
It absolutely. The other aspect is that Lyme disease isn't a continuous, it comes and goes, it ebbs and wanes. So people can do better and worse depending in part on their lifestyle, depending on factors outside of their control, depending on their age. So there are all kinds of reasons why things can change. And then, well, as your guest, Suzanne described,
yeah.
She described making a lot of lifestyle changes that accompanied her use of the coil. So she had stopped, for example, when people stop drinking, they often notice a lot of positive changes in their life and in their health.
Mm-hmm.
So regardless of what was going on in Doug's personal life, he believed that it was helpful. And so he published the plans to this, and he wanted anybody to have access to it for free. So clearly we've got a guy who's not in this for secondary gain. Larry Langdon is our next character in this story. And now we're getting really close to the amp coil story, because Larry is an engineer by trade, but he's lost his job. He's been really sick with a Lyme disease, and he's read up on it. Being an engineer, he's trying to understand alternate treatments. He stumbles upon the Doug coil and decides to build one for himself. He uses the Doug coil plan, and he makes himself a Doug coil. And he thinks it's working. He thinks it's helped. He feels more energy, and he feels a little more invigorated. So he's on a call with, he's in a self-help group, a support group for Lyme sufferers. And who should stumble into this group but Aaron Bigelow, who... Aaron is the CEO of Amp Coil. Okay. Aaron is part of this support group, according to Larry. Larry says that he met Aaron through this support group, and that Aaron expressed interest in the coil that he built, and could he build Aaron one? So Larry, being a nice guy, says, sure, I'll build you one, and I'll even bring it out to you. So he built him one, and he drove out to California, where Aaron lived. He and his wife ran a real estate business out there. And he brings him the amp coil. And Aaron was really impressed and said, hey, we could sell these things. To give you a little insight into where that idea is coming from, Aaron was formerly vice president of, and I did a pretty simple search. I just thought, where's this guy coming from? You know, like, how did this happen just out of the blue? He lists his previous job, the only one in terms of his LinkedIn profile, as the Quantum Alliance for QMV Biofeedback Support. So I, being so that I'm doing some investigating here, I think, oh, I'll Google these guys. I look up QMV Biofeedback Support. Greg, I could not make heads or tails out of what these guys were doing. QMV Biofeedback Support have this, a bunch of different devices, and they called it biofeedback. But yeah, I'm a psychologist, and biofeedback is biofeedback's a pretty well understood process. It's empirically validated. It's the only hitch is it requires some touchy technology. So for your listeners, to do biofeedback, you need to hook yourself up, say, to something that measures your galvanic skin response, for example, or your heart rate, or your pulse, or your respiration, whatever. And then you do whatever. You try to relax yourself, for example, and you get feedback from the device to tell you if your body is, if whatever is being measured is changing. And with the help of that feedback, you can experiment with the way you breathe, with the way you move, with the way you think, and you can learn to control whatever it is that you're measuring. And so it can be quite a powerful method for things like treating headaches. If they're vascular headaches, people can learn to control the blood flow to their head, for example, or for stress reduction, for relaxation. It can be very helpful for that. So this device, I think, but it's not. As I read the literature, it doesn't describe the biofeedback process. And this is where the history comes in handy. The device describes having a plate upon which you put handwriting or your hand, and then the device somehow translates that, and you're hooked with electrodes, and it will read your vibratory rate of your cells, and then it will feedback corrective vibratory rates. Okay. And it's called an electrophysiological feedback extroid device. And I thought,
it sounds impressive.
What is this? Anyway, you know, I sat it aside and I just kept looking into AmpCoil itself as a company. But over time, I kept stumbling across clues, and finally, the pieces fit together. I had read another fascinating article, somewhat similar to Kimberly Bailey's story, one of those ones you just have trouble believing. And it turns out, and so I thought, wait a second, I'm reading about this character who's on the run, you know, on the lam. He's left the United States. He had this scam. And I think, wait a second, QMV biofeedback support. I remember seeing something and there, I couldn't find any people associated with the company.
Huh.
Okay. And I couldn't find a location. And I thought, that's curious. This person that on the lam that I'd read this entertaining story about was in Belgrade, over in Hungary. So I went back to the QMV website and saw that there was a phone number. I put in the number, Google the area code, and it comes up for Hungary. Right. Oh my goodness. So the Quantum Alliance, this extroid device, Bill Nelson, William Nelson is a high school teacher up in Washington State. Okay? And he's not particularly successful in life, but he's got a bent for electronics, and he decides to build a health device based on the Rife mechanism, and he decides to hawk it as a cure-all. And he quickly becomes rich. He quickly starts selling them like hotcakes. And through the 90s and into the early 2000s, like he gets a huge business, and the FDA quickly gets onto his scent because he's claiming 100% cure. He's claiming that it can be used to treat cancer, Lyme disease, chronic fatigue syndrome, depression, anxiety, everything. So they start pursuing him, hounding him, and ultimately they're moving in to charge him and probably put him in jail. He's making money hand over fist. So what does he do? He leaves the country. And in the process, confuses his trail because he's going also under another name.
No
Desiree
way.
Desiree Dubinet.
Oh, my God.
He has an alternate ego who is a woman. And it turns out, and this really has nothing to do with being an entrepreneur or whatever, but he's a trans guy, you know. So, and he goes over to Budapest and opens what was known to be the most popular trans bars, uses the money he's made to open a huge, hugely successful trans bar over there, and also run his company, which is a worldwide empire by the early 2000s. And he's raking in not just millions, but tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars.
My God.
And continues to have a network of sales around the world. Immense. I had to admire this guy. Back in the early 2000s, he would make YouTube videos. You can find them. Where he, because he's a singer, and he liked to sing and be in a rock band in his bar. And he sings songs poking fun at and taunting the FDA. Like, sort of like, come and get me, you guys. You know. And his he's got a real personality. And he knows, and he's a really good speaker, and he knows how to make a buck. So that's some of the legacy here, leading into this device that we're talking about, AmpCoil. Now the change here is that AmpCoil is very careful not to cross the line. In the late 90s, and the reason that Desiree or Dr. Bill got into trouble was that he broke the law. In the late 90s, the Senate in the U.S. changed the rules on entrepreneurial businesses and help, and they made a bit of a loophole that allowed people to sell devices that weren't medical devices. So I'm making little quotation marks here, you know. So if you are an entrepreneur, the Senate wanted to encourage growth in industry. So they said, okay, we've had a lot of complaints that medical devices the rules are too stringent and it costs too much to get approval for a lot of businesses that aren't making medical devices. They don't want, you know, they're not. So they made a new category called wellness devices. And they soften the rules so that as long as you don't claim that you can cure diseases or diagnose diseases or mitigate diseases, then all you have to do is register your company. As long as your device is harmless, which PEMF devices are, they're harmless. It's like putting a stereo speaker on your body or a cell phone.
When you say registered, what do you mean? Registered as a medical device or registered in what way?
No, you're just registering as Rob Shepherd Zyroid Device Incorporated. And so they know I'm there, and they can check to see that they can go and Google me. And if they look at my website and see that I'm not claiming to cure, that I talk about, and then I'm allowed to sell a device that can help alleviate stress. Okay. Stress management is a big term that gets used on these websites because that has to do with the regulations. As long as you can use vague terminology around stress reduction or enhances energy, things that are really hard to measure and quantify, then you're in the clear. As long as you use people who review, who use your device and are willing to say positive things about it,
testimonials,
you're in the clear. Okay, you get people to make those personal claims. That's fine. So you know, for the listener, you really want to look for the clues,
the testimonials. I mean, how does someone going to a website believe that this is actually a true reviewer and a true patient that has used this? I mean, testimonials, I mean, they could just write that up themselves.
There's no law against that. You can say anything you please. If it's a personal testimonial, and I'm saying, and you'll notice on these sites often that the testimonials use similar language. So if I were writing a testimonial, let's say I'm an AmpCoil distributor, okay, and I'm thinking about it, because you get a lot. If I sell one of these devices, I'll get $1,000, up to $1,000, somewhere between 500 and 1,000 US, just mm-hmm. for
just
one
money
device.
To be made. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
And then just to use it, and I can get somebody to work in my practice to do it. I don't need to do it because it doesn't require, it doesn't do anything. I can have my secretary or I can hire some, you know, kid to put on a lab coat and administer it. And yeah. I can charge, you know, $50 or $100 an hour. We have a device similar to it up here that's being prescribed for, we have an elderly population up here. It's a retirement, you know, Collingwood area. There's a lot of wealthy older people with bladder problems. And there's a device like this, uses frequencies, and you sit on it, and it exercises your bladder apparently in ways that you can retain you can feel better as far as not needing to use your Depends or whatever, you know. And it's it, so this stuff is out there, and it's yeah. a lot of money. The practitioners can make a lot of money selling them. So of course I'm going to say, and as long as I say, you know, I tried this with Frank and he really seemed to benefit from it. Well, I haven't said anything that's going to get me in trouble.
No claims of cure.
If as a patient, I say, wow, it really, I just feel so much more energized since I've started using this device. There's no issues there. That's perfectly legitimate. And so let me be clear. This fellow, Amcoil, it's quite brilliant. Their website is very sophisticated. They use influencer. He's a well chosen. He's a body hack guy, right? So I can't remember word for word, but he says something to the effect of, I haven't had a chance to use this yet, but I can't wait to try it. You know, something like, but he's got, you know, a million subscribers or whatever. So use influencers, you pay affiliates. So you get practitioners and you make sure that they get a good profit from using your device by selling it to other people or by getting a good hourly. You show them how to do it, which he does really well. Amcoil really provides all kinds of educational material to teach their practitioners how to use the device and how to describe it and talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you steer around any claims. If you look at the bottom, anyone who goes to the Amcoil site, look at the bottom of the page, and it will say, not intended to diagnose, treat, or mitigate any specific disease. It says
treat, which is what everyone's talking about, that is treating depression, is treating Lyme disease. And on the very bottom of like the fine print says that?
Well, I can say I used it to treat myself and I feel a lot more energetic. I haven't, it's all fudgy.
Wow.
But it's on the site of all, and you know, I've talked about these guys. Larry, who claims that he got kind of hoodwinked when he gave this plan to Aaron and Amcoil came, because Larry got left behind. Well, he's got his own website and he's selling them too.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And a friend of Larry's who helped him design it, he's got his website and he's selling them too. And it's like comparing a Dodge to a Ford. They each have comparison charts and they range in price from anywhere from $3,000-$4,000 up to $7,000 or $8,000 per unit.
Right. I've seen that. Yeah.
Yeah. For a device that's not intended to diagnose, treat, mitigate any specific disease. Amcoil has sold upwards of 3,500 units.
My God.
Do the math.
Yeah.
That's beyond the 20 million mark. Okay.
The way that the people that are in the business of Amcoil, the way they make money, why does this sound a bit like Shaklee Vitamins years ago and Amway?
Because those companies use what's called multi-level marketing.
Yes.
And yeah. This is multi-level marketing.
Wow.
Only the difference is it's not a pyramid scheme.
Okay.
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 So the difference there, a pyramid scheme is when I hear from a friend, hey, I can sell this device and make lots of money. And my friend is getting paid for me signing up to sell the device. And
right.
You know, so it's it's got that extra layer in it that makes growth happen really quickly that can't sustain the business over mm-hmm. time, and where people are in, and people are investing money. In the case of AmpCoil, people are, you're just a distributor. You're buying these devices from AmpCoil, you know, or you're selling them for them. They're selling the device. You're getting paid
for it. Okay. Okay.
It's not a situation where you're building this pyramid that's going to fall down inevitably.
Yeah.
It's a business, and an effective business. And multi-level marketing is used everywhere. And it relies in part on affiliates are a big clue for multi-level marketing, which is essentially getting someone. Well, yeah, I don't know what Suzanne's qualifications are, but with devices like this, you don't need to have any qualifications. Anybody, a housewife, a fellow who's quit his job could sell this.
So there's no regulatory body looking after some type of certification for the people that are using this device. Is that right?
As long as I don't claim that I'm a therapist in the sense of a psychotherapist or, and there are practitioners like chiropractors who use it.
Yeah.
They'll use lots. And I have a friend who's a chiropractor and quite respect her, but when it comes to these devices, I just don't get it. I just don't get it. Because they do nothing and they cost a lot of money. And as I looked at them, I can think of a few chiropractors I knew who use similar devices where you hold on to a couple of rods and you kind of, whether you lean, anyway, my friend assured me that she bought one and it didn't do a thing. She ended up throwing it out because it didn't help her patients. And I was just surprised that she bought it in the first place.
If we can loop back to the interview with Suzanne Casamento, I mean, in the end, when Rob and I were talking about it, I kind of was on the fence at first. It really made sense to me at first, and I felt I was a believer. Then I was on the fence, and now I don't know what to believe. But the one thing that I came across that I want you to take a look at and explain is that maybe I'm wrong, but I thought the FDA approved the AmpCoil for fractures.
That's a whole other loop. In the latter part of the last century, veterinarians started experimenting with a coil type device, and there was some laboratory research done looking at healing, and we're looking at a different kind of process here. Okay, so when it comes to the kind of healing that these devices typically claim to do, we're talking like the Rife machine. We're talking about killing stuff that you don't want in your body. When we talk about it, its use, say, in veterinary science, which is where it started to be used, we're talking a horse with a broken leg or something to that effect. We're talking orthopedic injuries. And there was some early studies looking at using electromagnetic fields to try to alter cell metabolism. Okay. So that now the problem is that we have a lot of difficulty determining what is it that's actually happening when you do that. Because when you pulse an electrical field on in your body, it can have some side effects like generating a bit of heat. Okay. So it can generate heat.
Okay.
And so the long and short is, though, there seemed to be, in not quite half of the studies, there seemed to be some evidence that bone healing took place a little more quickly. Okay. And so that fed some enthusiasm for, hey, we could, and quickly, even though the majority of the studies didn't show that, and there were no agreed upon settings for the device. So meaning that out of a choice of hundreds, if not thousands of frequencies and hundreds or infinite number of durations, each study used a different setting and a different duration. And most of the studies had no effect, but some of the studies had appeared to have a positive effect. Well, that's enough to fuel a whole industry. And the devices are used in some clinics. In medicine, it's spread to the medical community and in orthopedic clinics, of course. And you can see I've described the economics of these devices, that it can be really appealing to sell and distribute them and for practitioners to use them, because you're promising something to a person that means a lot to them. I can heal my bone more quickly. But the evidence is very weak for the use of these devices for bone healing, and the American Medical Association does not it doesn't approve of them. They're allowed, but it does not promote them. It's not in their standards of practice as far as validated therapies. It is not on the list. Okay.
But I was quite sure that I came across that the FDA approved PEMF for bone fractures. So, like, how does that work between the AMA and the FDA? I mean,
the FDA is approving a device and its safety. And again, the outcome is not necessarily bone healing, but pain relief and swelling, for example, may be criteria. So the criteria are a little wishy-washy on that one. As I say, I did go down that rabbit hole and quickly found that it became another complicated story.
Really?
Yeah. But in the end, it's a very different application for this kind of device, and B, the evidence was still really unconvincing. Not as bad as the coil devices being used for any number of maladies.
Right.
Because there did seem to be at least some laboratory evidence looking at cellular growth. But we have to remember, if you're looking on a cellular level, and the kind of processes that go on in a cell when it's alive and growing and thriving, they're electrochemical. They involve the channeling of electricity through sodium. Well, you know, when you go to the doctor, they check your electrolytes.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Those are measurements of substances in your body that are useful and used for the functioning of organs like your heart and your cells, and that fuel the sort of the batteries of our body, you know.
And
the brain. So it isn't surprising that if you watch cells and you beam them with electrical radiations, that you'll see some changes. But none of the research I came across looking at that at that cellular level could predict whether it would be for the better or the worse necessarily. It's only when you get to clinical studies, you get into all kinds of wishy-washy stuff about control groups and the quality of the studies. And as I say, the AMA has judged that the quality is not strong enough for them to endorse it, but it's not weak enough for the FDA to say, hey, this is a sham, because the device itself isn't hurting anybody. And that's the FDA is more concerned about that aspect of the picture and about, again, claims being made that are unrealistic. And you know, I don't know about you, but I'm not reading all the time about miracle bone curing devices. It's only through this investigation that I stumbled across any of this.
And that's the thing, is that I really appreciate that you went into this deep dive, because it became an investigation. Our initial thought was that I had this interview kind of on the fence about this device. It kind of makes sense, but, you know, I've had a lot of questions. So you and I started talking about it, and then you did your research. It's almost like investigative journalism in a lot of ways, because we found out that there is name changes and murder involved in all this. But the question I will ask you is the same question I asked of you in other interviews and opportunities to challenge some of the interviews that we've had on the show, is for the average person, what would you recommend that they need to do before they start using a medical device that has all these claims? Because we're just going to see more and more of them. Biometrics is a huge thing. And the average person doesn't know the AMA from the FDA from anything. So what do they have to look for?
There are some very specific things that anybody can look for that would be very helpful. One would be that it doesn't matter whether we're talking about a scam or an approved device. Look for claims. Be suspicious if you see a claim that it can treat a wide variety of health problems. Even with very established, well-known, effective techniques, they tend to be quite constrained in terms of what they can treat. Okay. So, for example, a treatment of insulin, using insulin to treat diabetes. You don't use insulin for much else. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, using a pacemaker to implant in the heart. You know, you could go on and on. Most medical treatments, one could say, well, what about antibiotics? Well, they're treating a specific issue relating to a bacterial infection. Say, mm-hmm. when companies are claiming that they can treat a wide variety where they have a list of what appears to be unrelated problems, that's a sign your radar should be up
I
on
see.
That.
Much like we talked about with pharmaceuticals, is that initially a drug would, I don't know the drug offhand, was a Pfizer drug where, you know, first they said, okay, it's for this. And then all of a sudden Pfizer started saying, well, hey, guess what? This works for 50 things.
That's right. And so it applies across the board. It applies to, again, pharmaceutical drugs that are being sold, that one should be cautious if it's an off-label use.
Off-label, right. Yeah.
Right. That's called off-label. But, you know, the pharmaceutical companies generally aren't advertising, A, and B, they're not claiming that they can do all of these things. They have more sophisticated ways of doing it, I will say, where they use case studies and things we've talked about before.
And using the case studies with the doctors to get them to go off-label.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
You read your Lancet and, wow, that's fascinating. I'm going to try that. And away we go. Look for lots of jargon. Okay. And now maybe I don't know what jargon is. If it sounds really, really easy to understand and kind of appeals to your and almost musical and uses terms like body resonance, tuning your body, detoxing.
Yeah.
That again is a red flag. When the companies will often use this jargon, which is meaningless. Hmm. So one of the clues I'll say is, if you're not sure of the meaning, look it up in a medical dictionary and see if you can find it, okay? Because you won't even find it, okay? A lot of the terminology used on the, I won't name the websites, you know who we're talking about. Go and look, and if you look up the terms, you will not find those terms in a medical dictionary. And that's not a conspiracy theory. That's just an absence of science, okay, and an absence of facts.
So
another thing.
Go ahead.
You want to look at. Never trust any that thing that talks about a cure. Very rarely are we, even in the best of medicine, do we dare talk about cures. Doctors know that life is complicated and diseases are complicated. You get treated for cancer, you go into remission. It's rare that you get cured. And when you do, it's hindsight, not foresight.
Right.
Doctor doesn't say, hey, we're going to cure you. But afterwards, they can say, hey, I think we might have, you know. So again, if you're exploring information on the web or talking to people or a practitioner is describing this to you, that's a red button word. If they're using the term cure or 100% effective is another one. Mm-hmm. That's a real warning sign. Lots of vague, hard to define outcomes. So, and again, that's what tipped my curiosity. I was like, well, I can't really see what it is this is supposed to do. if you're reading it and you're trying to like, I kind of hear this resonance stuff, but it improves my energy, reduces my, well, I have Lyme disease. Do I want something that'll cure my Lyme disease? Do I really like improves my, well, I guess I kind of want to improve my energy. Yeah. That's a very vague, hard to define term. We all understand kind of what it means, but it's meaningless for that reason. Because
I think what really stood out for me when I started to really believe in this is the use of frequency, you know, not just from a radio background, but just my belief and understanding about frequency. And then that kind of gets into a lot of topics about, meditation and mindfulness and, you know, the universe vibration, all these funky things that, that, you know, are of interest to me. So at first I believed in it, and I appreciate that you provided this great investigative, research to kind of show, and I really don't know what to think, but I think it's important as we move along in, what we're presenting on the show is to bring you back. And if you have the time to do the research, have you come back and show the other side, because isn't that scientific, right? You know, it's showing two sides.
Yeah. And it's really important. And it's why I really got into this exploration, because there was so much more there. And it took, although it did take a lot more time than I expected, and brought me into places I'd never expected to go. In the end, it did lead to some of these basic rules, but also more insight into this is a bigger, much bigger problem than any of us realize. These tactics, of making unsubstantiated claims, of using this jargon that appeals to our heart, right? And appeals to our mythology and our the stories we've been told and our faith even. It can be abused. And we need to be more wary of these things. And let's face it, it doesn't take a lot for these companies to make a lot of money. So they're particularly aiming towards people who are vulnerable or are really desperate to pay the money. You know, a few other points, influencers.
Oh,
we should always be careful in terms of the use of influencers, and also affiliates. Your practitioner should not be selling you stuff. Be very careful. If you have a practitioner who's selling you stuff, your practitioner should be treating you, but they should leave the selling to somebody else. As soon as my college forbids me to get into that conflict of interest, and I'll get into trouble if I do that, if I do that in my practice. Some colleges are more forgiving, some aren't. And it gets complicated. You can't just trust that because it's a doctor you're dealing with, or a psychologist or a chiropractor, that you can trust. I do suggest that people be careful. Yeah. A fair question to ask your practitioner is, well, if I buy this thing, how much do you get?
They can ask that question.
There's no reason why you can't ask that question.
I guess for some people, they're afraid to piss off the doctor by asking that question, but I guess it is a fair question. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a totally fair question to say, you know, Dr. Sonia, I'm just a little uneasy. Do you by any chance get any kind of commission for this, or payment for this?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No. Well, oh, good. I'm just glad to hear that. I'm sorry if I, but it doesn't have to start World War III at all. It's a reasonable question to ask, because it's an unusual situation for a practitioner to be encouraging something if they appear to be the distributor. This is different than your doctor saying, oh, you need to eat more bran flakes in the morning. Okay. They're not selling you. They don't have boxes of bran flakes out in the waiting room, I hope.
They're not filling your pockets from Kellogg's.
Yeah. But it gets blurry, right? Because, my naturopath is selling me homeopathic remedies. If you're comfortable looking for evidence, you'll find none. That's a big red flag that there's no evidence. Look at the disclaimer. Look for the disclaimer. because it's on all these sites. I mean, skeptical or not, I think the words, you know, does not influence diagnosis, treatment, or of disease is pretty clear.
Okay. Yeah. And it's unfair that it's at the bottom of the website and maybe, you know, people don't read it.
Little tiny print. And who reads that stuff, right? It's down with the subscribe now. And who wants to go there?
Well, Dr. Robert, again, thank you so much for coming in. Thank you for your time, not only in the interview, but thank you for the time that you spent in looking into this a little bit further in the history of it so we have a better understanding. I can think of a number of things in the near future that you and I can take a look at, whether there's an interview or not. There's certain products out there I question as a therapist, and I think there's more opportunity to do more research in more of these interviews.
Greg, you know, thank you very much for sending me on what I thought was a wild goose chase, but turned up this golden egg.
Yeah. Well, I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. That's one hell of a story.
It's been a blast.
Well, thanks again. We'll talk to you soon. Definitely.
Super. Look forward to it.
What the hell, Rob?
Yes. Well, I told you this guy, Dr. Robert, he loves to research and he went down a couple of rabbit holes this time.
Yeah.
Like I was amazed just to hear I got a really good history lesson out of him today. And like way back in the day of Benjamin Franklin, and he really did his research, and it was amazing what we found out. And the other thing too, and we were just talking about this off air, the disclaimer at the bottom of the website. Okay, the FDA, they've put in some rules, if you will, but I mean, as long as you don't make a claim that this will do this or this will do that, as long as you don't make a claim, the FDA won't step in.
Right. If you're not saying it's a cure for something, right? Or a cure for cancer.
That's right. Yeah.
But I will add, because you know what? I'm sensing it with my spider senses, and maybe I'm giving off a little bit of EMF here. I'm picking up a little bit of EMF from the audience.
I'm feeling it.
I'm picking up on that energy, man. I bet there's a lot of people that are going to question Dr. Robert's research, and I gotta tell you, I gotta back him up. I mean he's part of our team, Rob, right?
Oh, he is, and this is why we had him on the show today. Because he loves to research, and I call him the master of Google.
Well, I think he actually uses Google to a certain extent, but I mean, Dr. Robert really is a doctor. I mean, he's a psychologist. He's been a good friend of mine for many years. He has spent years in clinical research regarding psychology and is, you know, has been my go-to. So I think there's probably some people that are going to try to poke holes into what he presented today. But it's credible. I mean,
it comes down to, and you and I talked about this off air as well, the power of marketing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, and you and I have been involved in one form or another over the years in marketing, our backgrounds in radio and so on. But I mean, it's like people talk about certain products and the testimonials. Oh, this was good for me. So it must be, it probably will be good for you.
And he was saying the testimonials don't really have to be credible. Like the companies could make them up, and there's no law against that.
And trust me, a lot of testimonials you see on the World Wide Web or wherever, they're all made up, for goodness sakes.
You know, you know? Could do a testimonial, right? Pros or cons right now, because you shared with me this week, since last week's episode, that you were given some type of blanket that you stand on. I believe that was PEMF, but I want to know what your testimonial is regarding this. And your wife used this blanket.
Okay, no, it's actually not a blanket. It's oh, how do I describe it?
A cushion.
It's a thing that you, not even a cushion. Oh. It's actually made out of plastic. And then it's got, electro fields. You put your feet on it and it sends pulses up through your legs. Like you can actually feel it tingling on, say, at the back of your calves, and you hear, and not hear, but you feel this. It's like power therapy.
Was this tingling going through all parts of your body, Rob? I'm just curious.
No. It was seriously though. It was through my feet. But you know, my wife and I, we got talking. I said, you know, you've been using this recently. It was my mom's, and after my mom passed, it was left around the old family house. Okay. And I said, oh, well, I'll grab this thing and see if it works. Now, years ago, if my memory serves me correct, Guy Lafleur from the Montreal Canadiens, he was the spokesperson for this thing. And it was to help, to help maybe your feet or just to better blood flow, okay. I guess. And so I asked my wife, I said, that thing that you've been using, I said, does it, like, especially after this conversation about AmpCoil, I said, that thing you're using, does it work? She says, not really. No, but I mean, with this AmpCoil thing, and listen, we're talking big business too, as the good
millions,
doctor pointed out, as the good doctor pointed out, you know, you've got a machine that runs, I'm going to say approximately $8,000 American.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's like $11,000 or $12,000 Canadian.
Yes,
and then there's kickbacks. So like, for example, if you and I went on and talked about AmpCoil and how good it is and whatever, we're going to get ourselves maybe $1,000 just for selling one of those
things. Dr. Robert even mentioned that. He goes, there's affiliates and it's all part of multi-level marketing.
Marketing, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Now, he wasn't suggesting, as he pointed out in the interview, it's not a pyramid scheme.
No, we're not saying that about AmpCoil. No, we're not saying it's not.
No, but it's the old thing. It's like people are getting paid, and it's a multi-million dollar industry by the sounds of
mm-hmm.
it.
Yeah, and caveat emptor, as they say, right? You know,
yeah.
Let the buyer beware. Wow. I don't know what to think. Like I said at the end of the interview, with Dr. Robert, I don't know what to think, but you got to wonder that. Okay, I'll tell you a very quick story what I know of EMF. Okay.
Okay.
And I won't be long with this. EMF, the first time I heard about that, when I was watching Ghost Hunters on TV, these guys would use an EMF gadget to determine is there anything in the house that could be, you know, a spirit or whatever. And somehow,
and they were using these little gadgets to say, oh, there's a ghost in here.
As yes. well as the gadget would pick up if there's extremely high EMF. Okay. So these gadgets mm-hmm. use a very, very low amount and pulsed frequency of electromagnetic energy. But they, I remember, went downstairs to one house and one of the houses had in the electrical system a really, really high amount of EMF coming off the electrical system that was making them sick. They were sick. They had headaches and everything else. So a little bit of this, I understand, is people believe it works and, hey, great, it works for you. But you got to really wonder that the same process in high amounts could harm you or even kill you.
Yes.
Once again, what the EMF is this?
What the EMF is this? Good one. I like that. Yeah. What the EMF? But no, it's the power of marketing. And I'm just grateful for the good doctor, Dr. Robert Shepherd there for he went down a couple of rabbit holes.
Yeah. Actually, when we were talking on the phone before we did the interview, he says, you know, to be honest, when you first mentioned this to me, I didn't think that we'd have any material to cover. He believed that he couldn't find enough information for an interview. But as soon as he started going and he started to look at the path of history and started to look at the people, the big money makers that were behind the Rife machine and all these other guys, then
that's right.
Then, yeah, apparently you spend hours and hours researching this. But once again, you know, our guy's credible. I mean, that's the reason we bring him on the show. I mean, you know, believe what you want to believe, but I got to say that he's a psychologist and he's very experienced in research, as you can hear.
A damn good one, for sure.
A damn good one. I can't wait to get him back on the show.
Very happy to have him on board. But yeah, great interview today with Dr. Robert.
Well, Rob, we're coming back next week with another episode of Keep Talking.
Or do you want to keep it secret? No, actually, we'll let the cat out of the bag. Our next interview on the Keep Talking episode of Mind Body Matters will be my old buddy, your old buddy, Brian Vollmer. He's the lead singer and one of the founding members of Helix.
Yeah, yeah.
Brian and I still keep in touch on a regular basis. And most recently, we lost a member of Helix, Greg Fritz Hines.
Yeah, the drummer,
He was the drummer and a dear old friend of mine. And he lost his life to cancer. So I want to talk to Brian about that. I want to talk to Brian about, you know, the music industry, maybe how it's changed over the years. But he's our guest next week on Mind Body Matters.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to talking with Brian. And what a get. Way to go, Rob. This is awesome that you're bringing this guest on with such a high profile. At least for guys that grew up in the 80s, you guys would have remembered Helix in addition to, you know, all the other metal bands and the hair bands, right? So people know who Helix is, so...
Yeah, heavy metal Canadian band, and Brian, in addition to having a great voice, he's a down to earth person, and he's a smart cookie too. So that's next week on the show.
Right. So we'll be back next week. Meanwhile, be kind to yourself,
and most importantly, folks, be well.
Be sure to like and follow us on all social media. And if you like what you hear, hit subscribe, download, and share with your friends. Mind Body Matters is a Great Media production.